Admission Straight Talk, Excipit.com's podcast on graduate admissions. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Excipit.com and the host of this podcast. I want to thank all listeners for joining us today. For today's segment of Admission Straight Talk, I've invited John Byrne to join us. John is the founder of Sea Change Media, Inc., quote, a digital media company creating niche business websites that combine original high-quality content with curation and community, close quote. It is the parent company of Poets and Quants, which is probably how most of you know John. And many applicants, MBA applicants, frequent the site for its insightful reporting on the B-school scene. In the past, John has served as editor-in-chief of Business Week and Fast Company. Early in his career, he authored or co-authored 8 business books, including several of BW's guides to B-schools, business schools, and Jack, Straight from the Gut, a collaboration with former GE chairman Jack Welch. He also played a major role in, he actually designed the initial Business Week rankings when they first came out in 1988. John, as I told you before we officially started, I'm very excited and somewhat intimidated to have you on the show. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join me here today. Welcome.
My pleasure. Linda.
Great. Your exposure to the business world is extraordinarily broad. But how did you start out on the B-School beat, and specifically with rankings?
I guess back in the late 1980s, was sort of the period of the true MBA boom, when the degree became incredibly popular and demand for it soared. And at the time, business media did very little coverage of the business school world. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of looking for a way to write a little bit more profoundly about what these business schools were doing and the people who went to get these degrees. And essentially, I kind of thought that ranking would be a good way to go about that. Why? Because obviously, there's some sex, drugs, and rock and roll to rankings today.
Forgot violence.
it was even more true back then when there wasn't much around. Right. And what a ranking did then was allow you, me, meaning the journalist, to get a lot more space in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And to get on the cover, right? Because otherwise, my editors would probably only be interested in one story, Harvard Business School, and nothing else. And you can't write that often. So,
otherwise, you have people leaving messages that this whole site is about Harvard Business School, right?
That's exactly right. You know, like Tootsie Rose Lee said, you got to have a gimmick. So my gimmick to get more space in the magazine to actually cover an area that I thought was very important was to create a ranking. Now, back in the 80s, there was something that was sort of interesting that was going on. There were surveys of generally HR people, and the surveys typically asked them were they satisfied with the MBAs that they brought into their organizations. And typically, they would say, you know, these people have incredible technical skills, they're great at analytics and data crunching, but they're not so good when they work with other people in our organization. Mm-hmm. They tend to be arrogant and overambitious.
That's much
change. Some people actually contended with, I'm sure, a good bit of hyperbole that most MBAs thought they could become CEOs after joining the organization in 3 or 5 years. When you went back to the business schools, and you echoed these concerns by the companies that actually hired MBAs, you sort of got a deaf ear. There was nothing happening. Uh-huh. So this information is kind of important because it led me to think, well, could I develop essentially a marketplace in a ranking where we would literally ask the companies that hired the MBAs what were the best schools based on their track records of people that they actually hired from the schools, and then ask the students who were just about to graduate what they thought of the 2-year experience they had. in a pretty extensive way. The first questionnaire was 35 questions and dealt with everything from school culture to the quality of the teaching in the classrooms to the emphasis on analytics versus soft skills to whether or not the Career Development Office, in their estimation, gave them the a good array of potential corporate recruiters that were brought on campus, job opportunities, and a lot of other things.
Uh-huh.
And we put these two things together based on the feeling that, okay, we're really trying to measure customer satisfaction.
Right.
And business schools really have two customers. They have the companies that buy the product, and they have the students who pay a good amount of money to go and get a graduate degree over a two-year period.
To become the
public. And in the case, yeah, and in the case of the MBAs, as you well know, you know, the opportunity cost to go when once you quit a job that's a fairly good job, and you add that cost in with the tuition and the fees, it's considerable. It's over $250,000 a year for the degree.
Yes.
And in some cases, it can be $350,000-$400,000, depending on what kind of job you're leaving and what kind of school you're going to. In fact, it's usually the second biggest investment a person will ever make in their life after they buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
So these people, because they also have work experience, are discriminating, and they have the wherewithal to make some very discerning judgments about what they thought about the education. So we put these two things together, and we came up with a ranking. And I will tell you, this was a total labor of love. It was my idea. I was printing out the surveys on my Apple Macintosh and folding paper in front of the TV. My entire family, all my kids, were laying on the floor folding these paper questionnaires and putting them in envelopes. It was that kind of project.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Of course, it's now much more sophisticated now.
Yeah, sure.
But it's no less controversial.
No. There's plenty of controversy around rankings. That hasn't gone away.
And in fact, a key part of what Poets and Quants does, I must say, is analysis of rankings.
Because
I have the dubious distinction of having created the first regularly published one, I know a lot about it.
Did your ranking predate U.S. News?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So basically, because of my involvement in that, I pretty much really know what a methodology can do and can't do, and what the obvious flaws of any system are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting problem, actually, that exists in the world of media and business school coverage, and that is this. No publication will ever either write about, never mind criticize, another publication's ranking, because there's sort of an unspoken code where the Financial Times doesn't want to give Business Week or U.S. News, or Forbes, or The Economist, any credit for their rankings, so they're completely silent about it, and that's true with any other publication.
Mm-hmm.
So, right from the start, given the importance of rankings and how obsessed people are with them, I strongly felt that it was an important part of the whole Poets and Quants agenda to take each of these rankings, tear them apart, tell you what the strength might be of a given ranking, what the weaknesses are, what kind of credibility you should attach to each one, and basically what they show. So, there's a tremendous amount of coverage on the site to each of the five rankings and then many of the other subsidiary rankings that are less influential. And then, of course, we do our own ranking, which is largely a composite of the five most influential rankings put out by Business Week, Forbes, U.S. News, The Financial Times, and The Economist.
Mm-hmm.
And that composite ranking is weighted on the basis of my own judgment on the validity of the methodology of each of the five rankings.
So which gets the highest?
Three.
The greatest weight.
Business Week.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yes, it certainly does. I'll tell you why. Because the beauty of the Business Week ranking is that it's all proprietary data. So in other words, when I decided to rank schools, I felt like anyone could go and get the school stats and throw them into a spreadsheet and rank schools any way you want. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do is to gather data that was never before available and to put it in the marketplace to actually make a market. And so the Business Week survey is sort of unlike any other survey in that it's based on largely the opinions of the two most important customers. So I think that that still has tremendous value. Yes, there are some significant flaws in the methodology that cannot be perfected. Nothing can be perfected. But it adds something that you can't get anywhere else. So that's why I rank it fairly highly. I rank U.S. News fairly highly because it is a pretty good data dump. Yes. And I think even though there are also significant flaws with that methodology, you're getting a good combination of many of the metrics that are often looked at to decide the quality of a school. You know, the average GMAT score, average GPA, average starting salary and bonus, percentage of class employed at graduation 3 months after. Mm-hmm. There's a reputation poll that is very controversial among deans in there.
Right.
And there's a very poorly designed poll of corporate recruiters to mimic the Business Week poll, but the design of that survey is pathetic.
At U.S. News or Financial Times now?
U.S. News.
Yeah. Really? I didn't even know they had.
And if you want to get, in the weed here, here's the difference.
Yeah.
When U.S. News surveys corporate recruiters, but they basically get the list of who recruits at each given school and then send the survey to everyone. So McKinsey might get, 50 surveys.
Right. They only refer to 10 schools or something.
Yeah, and not only that, but McKinsey shouldn't be getting 50 surveys. They should be getting one. And the one survey should go to the person who oversees the entire MBA recruitment effort. That's what Business Week does. But there's a lot of front-end work to determine who that person is and get that person to respond, rather than an alum from the school at McKinsey who ordinarily would just go to their old school. So, the design of the survey at U.S. News is completely flawed and the result is worthless. So that's one problem. But overall, I think the accumulation of all those other metrics
say
something. Yeah, and then I think the Forbes survey ranking is quite good, too, because it measures the schools on return on investment.
Yes.
And I think that's valuable, and it's simple, and it's easy to understand, and it's also different from U.S. News or Business Week.
Right.
And then the FT is next, and it's weighted less, and The Economist is weighted the least. And the reason is these two surveys are designed to favor non-U.S. schools purposefully, and take a lot of metrics that have nothing to do with quality, but everything to do with either political correctness.
Philosophy, political correctness, yeah, that's what I was saying.
Because
I'm trying to be politically correct and not say it, but failed.
The Financial Times, for example, will say, okay, what percentage of the faculty are female?
Right.
Well, yeah, I'd like to see a lot more women who teach at business schools, but it has nothing to do with the quality of the business school or the quality of the school. The Financial Times would give you extra points if more of your faculty have an international passport, a passport outside your domestic country. Well,
Europe is obviously going to walk away with that one.
If you look at a school that's based in a location that is no larger than a state in America, you're going to find most of its faculty to hold passports outside that nation because the nation is no larger than New Jersey.
Right.
Big deal.
Right.
Nothing. In fact, it might actually mean something quite negative, because by and large, many of those professors are not trained at world-class universities. But so there's a lot of extraneous, wacky stuff that goes into these, the Economist and the Financial Times surveys. So that's why I weight them less.
I generally advise applicants to use. I personally feel that rankings is a misnomer for most of these, whatever you call them. I agree, rankings has, as you put it, sex, drugs, and what was I said violence.
Rock and roll.
Oh, right. Sex, drugs, and rock. I can hear that. Certainly it sells magazines, and obviously you were absolutely brilliant in terms of designing. It achieved all that you wanted it to do. But in terms of my advice to applicants, it's always use the data, not the ranking, unless the rankings criteria and methodology really matches their own values and what they consider important in a business school.
I think I would add one thing to that. If you are going to use rankings, never use them for a year and never use one.
Okay.
Because what happens is that in any given year there are oddball anomalies that occur, and they occur because these methodologies aren't totally sound or because someone is gaming the system. And so I think the rankings have far more value when they're looked at over time.
Okay.
And by looking at them over time, you basically suppress those weird occurrences that may occur from year to year. And that's also the value of what we're trying to do with the composite ranking. Because once you look at all five in any given year and you smush them all together, you get rid of these anomalies as well, or you at least greatly diminish them, and you come to a greater truth as a result.
How did you come to focus? I mean, when you left Business Week, you've been editor-in-chief of this highly, highly respected business publication. You were at Fast Company. How did you come to focus on MBAs and graduate education?
It was really a function of my early beat at Business Week. I was the management editor.
Yeah.
And so as management editor, I covered things like management consulting, executive recruiting, strategy, how companies were run and led. And business school seemed to me to be a very natural outcome of that, because in part, to do my beat, I was often speaking to professors at business schools about strategy, about leadership. So it was sort of a natural outgrowth of my actual beat. And then what happened is, you know, I got into this in a very big way, and we did the guidebooks at Business Week. And in 1994, I built out the entire online presence for Business Week.
AOL.
Yeah, right.
That's actually where I first remember you from. You were responding in the forum to questions, much like I do now, probably not as well, but with incredible concision and insight. You were responding to, you know, what are my chances, where should I apply? I mean, tons and tons of those. I'm sure you remember this.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I remember doing so many. We did online chats with deans and admission directors, and the forums were a very big and important part of that, because that was, you know, early days of forums in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I'll just tell you, you know, even more recently when I left Business Week, really the only place at businessweek.com where we really had true community was the Business Week business school forums and the coverage that was done there. Give you a statistic that still blows my mind. I'm sure it's less true today than it was, let's say, 3-4 years ago when I left Business Week. The average user who visited Business Week's business school area did 56 page views in 1 month.
Wow.
Compared to the average user who visited businessweek.com
Wow.
Did two pages. So 2 verse 56, yes.
Wow, that is incredible.
Of the success of that whole enterprise, really. Yeah.
Now, is Poets and Quants aiming to be that kind of resource? And what are your plans for Poets and Quants, both in the B-School realm and outside it?
Yeah, well, obviously, when I left Business Week as executive editor and editor-in-chief of our .com operation, mm-hmm. and I left right after Bloomberg took over, mm-hmm. It was obvious to me that, look, I had a lot of knowledge in this area. I liked it. I have fun with
Clearly.
It. Something where you can easily put your arms around and know all the key characters pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's a place where you could do a lot of inside baseball kind of analysis, which is what I like, is it appeals to the geek in me.
Uh-huh.
So, and I knew there was an opportunity here because of the success that had been built up over the years at Business Week. So mm-hmm. it was an obvious first place to go for me. So that's how Poets and Quants really came about. And then, you know, we did the sister site, Poets and Quants for Executives, which covers executive MBAs and executive education.
Mm-hmm.
And our next site will be for law school. It's going to be called tippingthescales.com.
Should launch tippingthescales?
Yep, tippingthescales.com.
Okay.
And that'll launch in about a month. And really, the idea for Sea Change is to build out different sites for professional education. So engineering, medicine, education itself would come next. And my feeling is that what's happened is the undergraduate degree has become sort of the high school diploma for an earlier generation, mm-hmm. and that the graduate degree is increasingly becoming the real degree for college.
The real
degree. Professional white-collar jobs in America diminish in the future because of world competition primarily, that graduate degree is going to become increasingly important as a filter and a screen to get the best jobs in America. So I think that this is, an area that's not well covered in general. Business schools are much better covered than law schools, medical schools.
Oh, there's no comparison.
Schools.
No comparison in terms of.
I think there's even more upside in these other professional schools.
Well, law schools at the moment obviously are struggling because of the legal job market. But there still is no informative site comparable to either what Poets and Quants is today or what Business Week was. There's no quality site that I can think of off the top of my head. There are smaller sites. There are obviously the schools, but nothing that comes to my mind. The medical arena has a couple of really, really good sites. Student Doctor Network immediately comes to mind. But I don't think that it still offers what Business Week, does, used to, and Poets and Quants does now. So
engineering does nothing.
Nothing yeah. comparable.
And I'd say while it may seem contrarian to go into law school next because of the chaos in that market right now, where
that's a good description.
People have taken the LSAT have dropped by 25% in the last two years.
Right.
There's some law schools that are closing their doors, or other law schools that are making their class sizes smaller. There's great debate over the value of the degree and whether or not we're still producing far more lawyers than the United States needs. But here's what else has happened: all the second and third tier law schools, which never had to market themselves before, now have to market themselves.
Right.
And that is a very good
advertising dollars.
Yes, exactly right. That is a very good opportunity for the new site.
Yeah, you're also probably looking at the increasing retirement of baby boomers, many of whom. Our peers who defaulted to law. It was a very common default degree if you came out of the social sciences.
Definitely.
And liberal arts. So, you know, those people are going to be retiring. Our peers are going to be retiring in increasing numbers. So while law right now is kind of on the ropes, I don't think Americans are going to stop needing agreements. I don't think they're going to stop suing each other. So I don't think that it's down for the count.
Oh, no, not at all. Exactly.
Right.
And
right.
It's still, you know, the other issue here is that many people who ultimately go to business school earlier in their cycle may have actually thought about or considered going to medical school or law school.
And I think more law.
Yeah, and many people who go to law or medical school often go because you can go straight out of undergrad and you don't have to go and work before going to graduate school as you do in a, you know, a top quality MBA program.
Right.
So there is some, you know, connective tissue here in terms of where the applicants are at different stages in their own career.
So you are seeing increasing numbers both at law school and medical school of people who work for a year or two or more before going for that professional degree. It's not quite as unusual as it used to be. And in some law schools, it's actually very much encouraged. In medical school, it still is not the norm, but certainly some clinical exposure is almost a must. It just doesn't have to be full-time post-baccalaureate work experience like the schools.
Yep.
Now, you've written about the declining MBA application at full-time two-year programs. I mean, it's been all over the press. And there's no question that the numbers are down. I know, you know, you reported, of course, this is based on GMAC data, that almost two-thirds of U.S. full-time programs saw a decline in application volume last year. What's interesting to me, and I was looking at this and I'm thinking about it, the drop seems to be hitting schools very unevenly. Columbia is down 19%, but Cornell Johnson is up 17%. UCLA is up 22%, Ross is down 17%. GMAC has said that the app, and I know some people were pointing to the dismal market for financial services in terms of Columbia, but GMAC says that applications held up best in the Mid-Atlantic region, and Wharton, you know, it's the application volume. I think Chicago, too, was basically flat. I think Chicago was actually up a few percentage points, nothing major. Can you see any pattern in terms of which schools are the winners and which are the losers here? Do you have any theory?
Yeah, I'll throw something out, and I'm interested to see what you think.
Okay.
You know, the inner game of the whole business school world is actually quite a tough and competitive game.
Yeah.
And, you know, even the best schools have to fight for the best students.
Yeah.
And they fight for the best students by making sure that they have enough fellowship and scholarship money, mm-hmm. by being very aggressive by going out and, you know, selling themselves and marketing themselves, by doing something as simple as making sure that international students don't have to have a co-signer on a loan. So yeah. there are a lot of little factors that tend to get overlooked when you just look at these numbers and you're not really thinking deeply about why is it this way and why is it that way. So, you know, one of besides the problem with Wall Street in Columbia's dependence on Wall Street and financial services as a school, more dependent than pretty much any other school there is, because even Wharton is more diversified than diversified than Columbia.
Right.
Columbia also had the problem where they, for their international applicants, they had no loans
that
were available without a co-signer.
Right.
And so, you know, many kids who are outside the United States don't know someone in the U.S. is going to co-sign their loan.
Yeah.
And so if you can go to a school that doesn't have that hurdle, you're going to apply there and you're not going to apply to Columbia. And I think so some of this has to do with it. Also, just how good is the admissions office and how hard have they worked the marketing, the selling of the school and the brand, I think that has a big impact on this as well. In some cases where you have decline, you might have seen a change in leadership in a core function, and maybe there was, I'm going to just suggest that there was a dropping of a ball here and there.
Right.
And I think that that's also often to blame. But overall, when you just look at the numbers, what you're also seeing, I think, is the cycle. You know, this goes up and down, and the truth is that at all the best schools, the acceptance rates are still so low that it's not that much easier to get in, even if a school's applications have dropped by 20%.
Yeah.
Because
you're still talking about four,
still wanting to get in.
4 out of 5, right.
Yeah, there's so many still wanting to get in anyway. So it's not, I think, a dire thing. And I also think, based on what I have heard, that, you know, in the first round that we're just approaching, there's a sense that there's going to be a lot of heavy volume. As you know, a lot of the schools have made it easier to apply by dropping the number of essays required to fill out an application.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, the number of people who've taken the GMAT, which is a precursor in a way to MBA application flow, even though they take the GMAT for specialized one-year degrees and part-time and executive MBAs.
Also good for 5 years.
Yes. But the number of people who have taken the GMAT in the last testing period, which ended the end of June, mm-hmm. is at a record, historic record high.
Oh, okay.
So I think that that bodes well for what I think we're going to see a reversal of this decline in this coming application cycle.
Okay. In terms of my take on these numbers, I mean, some of it, I certainly think in terms of Columbia that the lack of no-co-signer loans is definitely a factor, and along with Columbia's dependence on financial services. But I don't think that that's enough to explain that size drop, again, considering that the other financial powerhouses did seem to do better. And in terms of UCLA, I mean, I think both UCLA and Wharton did something in common, and I think it helped them. And that is they made their curriculums much more flexible so that applicants can dive in the first year into courses that are going to help them land internships and then take the other courses to kind of round out their business knowledge in the second year. And I think that probably they put it out there really effectively, and it probably helped them maintain their application volume.
Yeah, good point. Good point. And UCLA certainly did that with.
And, they did it really strongly. Yeah.
Yeah, they did it. They tied it totally directly to a marketing campaign to get more applicants, and that curriculum change really is. It's actually quite smart because it's directly related to career outcome, right?
They're
basically saying, look, if we can get you on track earlier in the cycle, we can get you a better internship, we're gonna have a significantly increased chances of getting you the job that you want. So we're going to kind of put pressure on you to make a decision early on in the cycle and then give you those courses right away and put you on that track so that the degree pays off right away. And that's sort of pretty smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that actually is a really smart move. And the other thing with Cornell's increase is obviously they have a new dean coming in. They just got that high-tech center in Manhattan they're going to be developing. They just had a lot of really good things going on, and they did market very aggressively and effectively, clearly. So that would be my take. But it's not exactly a unified theory. What do you see for business education, management education in the next couple of years going forward?
Well, I actually am truly bullish about it. I think that the value proposition is going to get a little bit better. You know, over the last 10 years, while there's no question that the MBA degree is one of the most valuable degrees you can get,
right,
there is definitely payoff in most cases, and we're not even talking top schools. We're talking the overall range of schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids see their salaries go up by anywhere from 85 to 110% from the pre-MBA salaries right out of school. And there's almost very few other degrees that you could get to mm-hmm. see that kind of quick and fast payoff.
That's true.
And that, like I said, that's the full range of schools. That's not the best schools where it's very common that people will better than double their pre-MBA salaries after graduation. So, but it's also true that over the last 10 years, there have been very significant increases in tuition and fees, and basically the return has diminished. Even though the return is still very high, and there's no question that the degree is worth it, the returns have diminished in the last 10 years, in part because starting salaries have remained relatively stable or have only increased slightly. This is in no small effect due to the 2008 economic collapse,
right,
some of which we're still obviously dealing
very
with right
dealing
now,
with.
Because mm-hmm. it is the topic of the presidential election.
Yep.
So what I do think, though, is that we're going to see over the next few years the value proposition grow back again to even be a little bit better. I think this is true because MBAs, even through this economic crisis, have been in very high demand. Particularly the consulting firms have been booming all over the world in hiring tremendous numbers of MBAs. And when you talk to the consulting firms and you ask them about their future prospects, they're actually worried that they can't get enough MBAs in the future to fulfill their growth needs.
Wow.
So, and I also think...
You want to say that again so that listeners will hear it?
Yeah. And I also think that the decline of the financial sector, I think it's pretty much done. I don't foresee further cutbacks of any kind of substance in the financial sector. So I actually think kind of we've hit bottom or close to bottom, and that you're going to be seeing some revival there as well. So I'm very optimistic that over the next 3 years, the MBA degree is even going to become more valuable. And then you have this whole new rise in specialized degrees.
Yeah.
These one-year degrees, which is sort of very interesting. They're creative, they're innovative, and they're more readily available for younger people without work experience or very little work experience. And I think that will continue to grow and be a very big boom for business schools that diversify their portfolio of offerings.
Agreed. Agreed. Do you have any last-minute words of wisdom for applicants applying this fall?
I don't know how wise they are. But here's what I would say. You know, I just say this. You know, you got to throw yourself into this and truly devote yourself to getting as high a score as you can on either your GRE or your GMAT. And you got to spend the time and the thinking process to know why you really want the degree and how you think it's going to pay off for you. And you got to do the spade work to pick the right school. Visit the school, talk to the students, talk to alumni. Get a sense for what the degree can give you, what kind of career options are open to you once you get a degree. And then you got to really buckle down and go into a cave and, you know, go through these applications and do them as best as you possibly can and have other people read them for you or hire an admissions consultant.
I like that idea.
Guide you through the process, right?
Right.
I think But it is, it's almost like a full-time job. And you have to give it that kind of attention to make it be a successful journey for you. And I think if you do all that, I think the payoff will be there. And it doesn't mean that you have to get into Harvard, Stanford, or Wharton, or Chicago, or Kellogg, or Columbia. There's a lot of great schools out there, and a lot of schools that will do for you what you want. And the three things are deliver academic excellence, get you a great job, and put you into an alumni network that will be valuable for the rest of your life. There are, you know, at least 50 or maybe even more when you look at the global arena of schools that will very easily do that for you. They may not do some other things, but they will do those three things. They'll get you great teachers in the classroom, they'll get you a great job, and they will get you a great alumni network.
And a great experience while you're in it.
Absolutely, because as you know, most of the people who go to business school come out very happy.
Yes.
And they say it's one of the best decisions they've ever made in their lives.
Yeah, I think it's well over 90% actually are very happy with that they went to business school. There aren't too many decisions that have that kind of unanimity. No, very few decisions. I mean, 50% of marriages end in divorce. There are very few decisions that have that kind of approval with hindsight. But I can't agree with you more in terms of the advice that you gave about doing your homework, even if you hire an admissions consultant to guide you through it. Certainly at accepted.com, we strongly encourage, we pretty much insist that they have some kind of goal in front of them, that they do have some sense of priorities. Even if we guide them in developing how can you, for heaven's sakes, you don't get into your car unless you have a destination. How can you take 2 years off work, again, the opportunity cost, make the investment in the education, and not know what you want to do, and not know why you want to do it? So I couldn't agree with you more, and I definitely think you gave words of wisdom in answer to my last question. I think our podcast is just about over. John, where can people learn more about your work? I mean, you gave, let's just give the URLs again.
Yeah, poetsandquants.com.
Okay.
Poetsandquant4exec.com.
Okay.
And soon to be tippingthescales.com.
Okay, I guess that'll be in about a month. I look forward to visiting that site and learning more from you about the law school admissions scene then. I want to thank
and
you so much.
You know, one other thing, yes? I should just mention.
Sure.
The payoff.
Okay.
One of the stories that we did recently, and it's sort of interesting, we got our hands on a PowerPoint presentation,
yes,
that was made at the Harvard Business School last year.
Yes.
Now, people who know about Harvard know that when a class celebrates its 25th anniversary at its reunion, what is,
yes,
typically done is a survey of the class members. And usually this is all proprietary data. You never get to see it unless you're a member of the class. We found this PowerPoint presentation,
mm-hmm,
and for the class 1986, that went back to campus last year to celebrate the 25th reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And here, what they found. They found out that the median annual income was a member of their class is $350,000.
That's pretty good.
That's darn good. They,
yeah,
found that the personal net worth.
I could handle that. Yeah, go ahead.
$6 million.
Wow. Net worth. Woo.
Yep.
That's pretty good.
Nearly 8 in 10 owned a second car. Mm-hmm. 4 in 10 owned a vacation home.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 4 owned a boat. 1 in 10 owned a full or fractional share of a private airplane.
Hmm.
Not so bad.
No, not so bad.
And almost all of them attributed a very great deal of their success to the MBA degree.
Right.
So, there you have it.
You know, I sometimes, just before I do close this, I frequently see the argument, the MBA doesn't provide the ROI that it used to. I don't want to do it because it doesn't provide the ROI that it used to. And my answer to that is, frankly, it's irrelevant. The question is whether it's going to provide you ROI today and tomorrow.
Right.
What it provided in 2000 or 1990 is completely irrelevant to your decision-making process today. The question is only, what is it going to provide you going forward? If it's going to be positive, if it's going to be positive, then there's good grounds to go forward. If it's going to be negative, well, you have to ask if you want to incur the expense as opposed to make a positive investment. But what it was 10 and 20 years ago, it's water under the bridge. You weren't around then.
That's very true.
So, well, anyway, did you want to add something to that, John?
Oh, no, that's enough.
Okay. Thank you so much for being our guest here today and sharing your knowledge of the graduate admissions world, and specifically the graduate management education world. I'm confident that any applicants who tune into this podcast will be much better informed and really have a very thoughtful perspective on the process, a more effective application process for them as a result. Listeners, thank you also for joining us. Please share your feedback. 5-star reviews on iTunes are particularly welcome. You can leave feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing Linda@Accepted.com. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted.com, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.